Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of April. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about a record of the civil rights movement here in Milwaukee. And our guest is Margaret Rozga. She is the author. Last time we talked to her, she was the playwright of a play that dealt with 200 nights in one day in the civil rights movement here in the city of Milwaukee. And she was a part of it for many years. The foreword to her new book, and 200 days in one night, is the open housing marches that took place in the 60s here in the city of Milwaukee. The foreword of the book is by Dick Gregory. This is a book of poetry, and a lovely one it is. It takes us, as he writes, through the brave history of the strength, commitment, and passion of the people of Milwaukee as they marched, struggled, and were jailed to win the victory of justice and freedom for all. Peggy joined the protesters, participated in freedom marches, and was jailed for fighting and marching for the rights of poor black children of the city of Milwaukee under the leadership of one of the great advocates of nonviolence, direct action, and civil disobedience of our times, Father James Gropi. Margaret is now teaching, and she is at the University of Wisconsin-Waukesha. She's a professor of English, and in between she writes about her life. It's been a big life. The peace movement, graduate school, marriage, establishing a family, being widowed, then as a single parent of three children, struggling with the anger and grief precipitated by great loss. But as she writes, anger propels you forward, grief slows you down. And so she has really been propelled forward and has lived this history and written about it. And we're happy that she's done a book of poetry about it. I'm going to call you Margaret. I love Margaret because it's my favorite name. Margaret O'Leary was my favorite aunt, and I know people call you Peggy and Peg, but if you don't mind, indulge me and let me call you Margaret this hour because I love saying the name. Hello, Margaret.
Hello. Hi. Actually, my family calls me Margaret, so that's good. That's good.
That's okay.
That makes you family.
Yeah. I'm so glad you did poetry because it you get to a lot with poetry that you may not even in a play. There's something, you read it and it stays with you and you read it out loud. And the words are sometimes more powerful to me than any other form of communication.
Well, I consider myself primarily a poet. I've been writing poetry for some 20 years now. And it is a struggle to define what a poem is, but I think you hit it on the head. I think the idea of language as it's used in its most resourceful way is poetry. And I wanted to capture some key moments in the open housing campaign in Milwaukee, and it seemed to me that poetry would allow me to do that.
Have you kept really extensive records of all that happened in the city during those years, Margaret?
One thing that really helped me is when my husband was dying, Father Gropi was my husband. When he was dying, a classmate of his from the seminary brought a scrapbook that he and his wife had made that was a record of the civil rights activity in Milwaukee. And I was fortunate enough to inherit that. So it was a real convenient place to go back and refresh my memory. And what I found was, the more I thought about it, the more I wrote about it, the more it came back to me. I'd be in the middle of writing or thinking about something, and suddenly a whole scene would flash before my eyes, just as though it were playing out today. And it began to feel like it's all still living there somewhere in my soul and my psyche. And you just have to find the right prompt to bring it to the fore
right.
Again.
And what about in your students and young people now? The 60s to me doesn't seem that long ago, but I'm wondering if it lives in the soul and the psyche of young people now, or if that era is so long ago and maybe not studied or remembered as it should be that it's forgotten.
Well, this was one of the questions that always came up in the talkbacks after the performances of the play. Somebody in the audience would ask the young actors, the students who were playing the parts, what did you know about this before you were cast in this play?
Uh-huh.
And the answer was, well, nothing.
Really? Oh, my.
And that was true of both the white actors and the African-American actors. There was a difference, however, when the white actors went home, they didn't get much additional information from their families. When the African-American students went home and said, I'm in this play and it's about marching for civil rights, and their parents would say, oh, well, that's Uncle Walter and that's Grandpa, and would start to tell family stories, which might have gone untold except for the initiation of the discussion on the part of the students. And actually, as the conversations went on in the talkbacks, what emerged, and I see this in my classes too, when we cover some historic event that students think they didn't know, and then when they find out about it, they think they should have known, is anger. Why didn't anybody tell me this before? So one of the things that actually the publisher, Leroy Chappelle at Banu Press, is thinking is that this book, it's accessible poetry, it's serious poetry at the same time, and it's also history, that teachers would find it very teachable for their classes so that we could begin to address that gap in what students know about their own history. I was just talking to a history professor at UW-Milwaukee the other day who told me about a very promising young student, an African-American student from Milwaukee who is doing some research on the civil rights movement, went to Riverside High School, had a course in Milwaukee or Wisconsin civil rights history, and didn't know anything about the open housing campaign. And she was mad. You know, she and now she's on kind of a crusade of, let's tell the story in the city. Let's celebrate our history. Let's celebrate the heroism that we saw enacted on our own streets.
Right. And there's something about the title which is striking to me. 200 nights in one day. 200 nights of marching in one day. That's a lot of time, isn't it, Margaret?
It definitely is. And actually, as I've been doing readings from the book, that is a question that often, were there really 200
right.
nights? 200 consecutive nights? People came out night after night after night. And, I guess because I lived it, I took it for granted. And it didn't seem so remarkable to me until I started getting feedback from other people saying, this is really remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, it is remarkable. For those who don't have much of a sense of what those marches were, tell me about the Youth Council. Tell me about Father Grappi's involvement in this and your involvement, too, why you decided to join the council and the impact and the genesis of the open housing movement in the city of Milwaukee.
Okay. My own civil rights involvement began when I volunteered to work down south on a voter registration project, a Southern Christian Leadership voter registration project in 1965. A group of us from Milwaukee volunteered together and then served in the same county in the south, Bullock County, Alabama. It's about 50 miles southeast of Montgomery. When we came back, especially Nathaniel Harwell and I, decided that we would continue to be involved. Well, he had been involved before. I hadn't. And I felt like I would be a hypocrite if I had gone down south to be involved and then did nothing at home. And it was the Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council that was in the forefront of civil rights activity at the time. So that if you wanted to be involved, that was the place to be involved because it would be fairly easy to join in action. At that time, the Milwaukee Youth Council was involved in a campaign in regards to the Eagles Club, had a whites-only membership clause. But the problem was that judges were members of the Eagles Club, and so they were supposed to be impartial on the bench, but in their private life, their so-called private life, they belonged to a segregated club. At the time, people told us, oh, this isn't a good issue. This is a privacy matter and so on and so forth. But it's become kind of a standard test.
Yes.
So I think the Youth Council was forward-thinking in a lot of ways. So the Youth Council established a reputation as the activist group, the group to go to if you had issues that you wanted addressed. And what happened was there was an urban renewal project going on in Milwaukee, the Kilburn Town 3 project, where a lot of houses were being torn down in inner city neighborhoods. But the people who were living there, African Americans, had no place to move. If they moved west of 27th Street, they were subject to a lot of harassment from their neighbors. Their kids got beat up. Mm. They got graffiti on their houses. And so there was no place to go. And people were doubling up, tripling up in houses. A young African-American veteran, a Marine, who had served in Vietnam, returned and was trying to find a place to live, rent a flat with his wife and his infant daughter. They went to a place, he tells me it was on 29th and Burleigh. And the owner said that she had already rented it. They didn't quite believe that. It didn't seem like that could have happened that fast. So they asked, you know, they pursued the question. And finally the owner said, I can't rent to you. What would my neighbors think? So he came to the Youth Council for support. This was around Christmas time in 1966. So the Youth Council went and sang Christmas carols to the owner.
To the landlord. I love that story. To an open door, or were the windows boarded?
It was no visible response from the right. owner. And it became obvious that this dealing with every case on a case-by-case basis would take forever and was not the way to go. In the meantime, Alderman Val Phillips had actually introduced a fair housing bill four times in the Common Council. Every time she was the only person to vote for it. So Father Grappi called her and asked her if she would like some support. And she said yes. The spring of 1967, the Youth Council picketed at the homes of aldermen who were voting against the bill, but who had African-American constituents. When the bill came up again, they still voted all against it. So we thought we have to escalate the campaign. There was an interruption in the campaign, and that was the riot, so-called riot on 3rd Street. I sort of hate to get started on. And this is kind of a pet peeve of mine, that the summer of 1967 in popular memory is remembered as the year of the riots. And I think the historically much more significant action was the open housing campaign. When Barack Obama was elected president, the story in the Milwaukee Journal about the celebration in the African-American community began with the sentence, 41 years ago, Milwaukee was a scene of riots, plural. And now people are celebrating the election of an African-American president. And, there's a sense in which that is correct. There were riots. If we grant that the disturbance on 3rd Street was a riot, but if you want to make it plural, riots. The other riot was a white riot on the south side when the Youth Council marched to Kosciuszko Park.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't think of white people rioting.
Mm-hmm.
If you say riot, the usual reaction is that must be African Americans, and it reinforces a stereotype of violent behavior and so on. I wrote to the editorial page editor and asked for time to respond to that article. And I was told that if I wrote a letter, they would consider whether it were newsworthy and think about printing it. And so I wrote the letter, and they never printed it. And it bothers me that we perpetuate this image of rioting, but we don't claim what is really an example of effective action. We don't give young people today a model of how they can address social issues. And they might address them in different ways, and their issues would be different. But they need models of young people being concerned about civic affairs. And they don't get them if we perpetuate this idea of 1967 as a year of rioting. A friend of mine told me she moved to the city shortly after 1967. She said, I never heard about the open housing marches, but I sure did hear about the riots. And if we can do anything to correct that perception and correct that understanding, I think that would be a gift to the young people of this city. They would have a model of what young people in the city have done to stand up for social justice, and I think that's what we need.
Right. And so many of the stories, the pictures show, I think, some of the riots that took place on the south side of this town. What's amazing to me about this is, in some ways, we've come a long way, but the fact that Vel Phillips, as you just said, had to introduce this four times, that there were people who have become somewhat respected politicians since then who voted, everybody voted against open housing in 1967 is amazing to me, Margaret, isn't it? What was going on? Why was it such a hot-button issue? Why was this city, it still is segregated, but why was everybody trying to keep that model alive?
Yeah, it still is segregated, but at least there's legal recourse for people who are discriminated against. They argued the rights of private property. You know, I don't know what all was going on with them. Chief Harold Breyer at one point said about integration of the schools that he was opposed to integration of the schools because it would just spread black crime all over the city. So I suppose that was somewhere in the back of people's thinking. People may have been fearful of losing the investment that they had in their home, but the practices by which real estate were devalued were practices that were perpetuated by the real estate companies, the practice called leapfrogging. You know, they would sell a house several blocks beyond whatever was the cutoff line at the time to a black family and then call all the white homeowners in the neighborhood and say, blacks are moving in, do you want to sell? So whites would sell at deflated prices, and sometimes the same day that same house would be sold to a black family for double what the companies had paid for it. I actually did see records of that sort once from George Pezik at Northtown Neighborhood Association. So creating a segregated community was not something that happened because people prefer to be with people, you know, of the same colors. It was constructed. The house that I grew up on 44th in Oklahoma, the original deed to the property had a restrictive covenant in the deed. You know, any attempt to sell this property to persons of Negro descent shall be null and void. You know, there is a good program video put together. John Goethe was involved in that, the making of Milwaukee.
Yes.
But you get the impression as you go from the housing boom of the 50s into the civil rights action of the 60s that it kind of came from nowhere. You know, but the confinement of the black of African Americans to the black community was something that was done by deliberate measures to keep it that way. So reversing that takes more than 200 nights.
Right. Margaret Rosgay is our guest. We want her to read a poem. I will have her read several during the course of this hour, but I'd like for her to read the first one in the book, which gives you history, as most of them do, Prologue to Milwaukee, and that's coming up in just a moment. We're also welcoming phone calls for Margaret. Her book is A Book of Poetry, 200 Nights and One Day, and it's a record, really, of the civil rights movement, the open housing movement here in the city of Milwaukee, and the ingredients of how victories were won in Milwaukee. We'll ask her about Dick Gregory, who wrote a lovely preface to this book and was, he says, honored to have been invited to march side by side with the people of Milwaukee. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Some of you may remember this time in Milwaukee history quite well because you were living it, and we'd be interested in your reminiscences. And what about how important it is to remember this kind of marching, this kind of event that took place for such a long period of time? Why was it so hard? What was happening nationally on this scene as well? Why did it take so long to get the Milwaukee Common Council, and what finally moved them to pass an open housing ordinance here in the city of Milwaukee? We got all our phone lines going. All right, we'll take your calls in a moment. And we also want to tell you the email talk address, which is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be taking phone calls for Margaret in a moment because it is a book of poetry, and she is a poet, and I want her to read during the course of this hour as well. So she will be reading, and then we'll go to your phone calls. Prologue to Milwaukee. You're on, Margaret.
Prologue to Milwaukee. Before Milwaukee and south of Wisconsin, people on the march, boycotting buses. No more pay up front to go to the back. No more sitting in the back. No more looking down, looking away. No more. No more. People on the march, sitting in at lunch counters, Greensboro, Nashville, denied service, beaten, jailed, but their spirit resists arrest, advances. People on the march to the county courthouse, Washington, D.C., the Lincoln Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, all the way from Selma to Montgomery, Chicago into Cicero. Cicero? History remembers the dream, forgets nightmares. But those startled awake, stay awake, remember, try again, march on, inspire individual photos, moving pictures. People on the march, moving north, Milwaukee, moving into the heart of a young African American woman, a lawyer, married to a lawyer, but they live with negatives. Blockbusting, restrictive covenants. People on the march, moving a young African-American man, a Marine returned from Vietnam seeking a home for his family, told by the owner, I can't rent to you. What would my neighbors think? People on the march, moving the heart and soul of a white Roman Catholic priest at St. Boniface Church. He listened to the Vietnam veteran. He watched the young African-American woman win election to the city council, introduce a fair housing bill, vote alone for that bill, time after time after time. People on the march, moving into the deepest fiber of the teenagers playing basketball on neighborhood playgrounds, the young adults on the streets who could not find work, not the Milwaukee of happy days. Though it is that same time, that same place. People on the march, moving history into drama. The setting, Milwaukee, St. Boniface Catholic Church, the 16th Street Viaduct, the 15th Street Freedom House, Kosciuszko Park, Wisconsin Avenue, City Hall, the city jail. The cast of characters, people, young and old, black and white, powerful and challenging power, cowardly and courageous, stodgy and on the move. The plot, wind from the south-southeast, dreams, nightmares, closed doors, closed still. The rising action, the turning point, the denouement, lights, camera, action, 200 nights of marching, people on the march, Milwaukee. An epilogue, maybe in your steps, maybe the other side of that long expanse of bridge you think you can't cross.
Thank you, Margaret. That's got it. That's what it is. All right, let's go to some phone calls. Don from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Don.
Hello, good morning.
Hi.
One of the lasting effects or gifts of the open housing marches was the effect that it had on the clergy and certainly on the Catholic clergy directly, because many of us had we were liberal and we were progressive, but to think that we had an obligation to be involved, and that Jim wasn't just a wild guy going over the edge, but he was actually in the center of what we should be doing, and the concept that that the evil of racism was in our midst, and that we couldn't preach on Sunday and then not do something about this on Monday. So my thanks to Jim and to Peggy and to the Youth Council and the whole movement was that it awakened that, and it's sort of like now we say, oh yeah, that's true, we all agree on that, or at least most of us agree on that. It took a long time for that to come, and the open housing marches were a catalyst for that.
Did you march, Don?
Oh yeah. Peggy and I, we knew each other, and I certainly congratulate her on her book, and the 201 days is going to be on my shelf.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for calling. I think it is true that there was an awakening in the Catholic. St. Boniface became the center of the civil rights movement in Milwaukee, and it was a wonderful thing to see. I'd like to see a plaque up on the corner of 11th and Clark commemorating.
Well, that's a good idea. Okay, 11th. Of course there should be one. It's a great idea. Well, in a sense, too, written about by Dick Gregory, who was here marching, that it was one of the centers of the civil rights movement in the North and in the country at that time, too. This was receiving a lot of attention.
I think what we don't understand in Milwaukee is that Milwaukee was a national campaign. Historians are beginning to look at the civil rights movement again and to see that the civil rights movement or movements in the North have not gotten the attention by historians that they should get. Actually, there's another book out just recently. Harvard University Press published it by a young historian, Patrick Jones. His book is called Selma of the North, which is what Milwaukee was called during the open housing campaign by people who lived outside of Milwaukee.
Thank you very much for the call. And what about the responsibility of the spiritual community to respond to this? What did Father Grappi say about that? What did he feel was a spiritual obligation, if there was one, to address this issue?
Well, he often said, what is a priest to do if a parishioner comes and says, Father, they won't rent to me beyond 27th Street? To say, well, pray or make the best of it didn't seem to him to be the right answer. Actually, he had an interesting story about that. When he was sent to St. Boniface, he was told by the chancery to work on conversions. And he did. He went door to door in the neighborhood, passing out Catholic literature, asking people if they wanted to become Catholic, and talking about, information classes and this sort of thing. One of the houses that he went to turned out to be a family that already belonged to St. Boniface, the Harrises, whose daughters were active in the Youth Council, and the NAACP Youth Council at that point needed a new advisor. So he was going door to door. Yes. And they said, well, while you're here, let's talk to you about this other thing. And then during the school boycott, there was a point at which the auxiliary bishop, Otkielski, forbade the use of Catholic facilities for freedom schools during the school boycott to protest injustices in the school system. And Father Graffi had to lead 500 children away from St. Boniface to the Baptist Church on North Avenue, where they could go to freedom school. And he said, I was told to work on conversions, and here I am leading 500 children away from the church. I don't think they know what they're doing.
Let's go to Tim from Mount Zion. Hi, Tim.
Greetings. Yeah, lovely show. I was a student at the University of Minnesota in Morris. It's out in the western Minnesota, and a bunch of us, this is 1969, we're going to shut down the university like they had at the main campus earlier, and kind of an enlightened administration out there. So actually, they compromised and had us teach in. And Father Grappe was our quote, headliner on quote. And he was a very busy schedule. So a friend of mine had an airplane. So my friend and I went down to he flew to Minneapolis, and we picked him up in a small plane and flew him back out. So that was delightful. But my impression was a man on a mission, and we got funding for this event, a week-long event, so we had a healthy stipend for him. So, but anyway, he did a terrific educational job, you know, with our students, and everyone was just like very inspired. But of course, we're in western Minnesota, and the problems are different. But my impression was just his dedication, and he just, as soon as that event was over, he was back in the city, on the streets, you know. So it was just delightful having him, and you know, the vibrations that he caused reverberated, and that's part of it. Anyway, that's my little story, and great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I'm glad you called him. I'm sure Margaret is, too.
I am, and actually, all of those stories, I would really like to collect all of those.
Imagine.
Untold stories and recognize the extent to which people were involved and the range of people who were involved. And your story in particular highlights what can happen when there is an enlightened administration. You address problems and you talk about things. That's the intelligent thing to do rather than pretend that they don't exist or to heap blame upon people. You know, a very different kind of thing happened at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. One of the members of the youth council went to school there. And at the time, there were, I think, about 94 African-American students at Oshkosh. They raised an issue about textbooks and African-American history, and had a sit-in at the chancellor's office. A couple of students did some damage in the office. Historians say probably not more than 12 were involved in that, but all 94 were expelled from Oshkosh. It's another one of those forgotten instances that at long last is beginning to be recognized. Professor Stephen Kircher at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh has put together an exhibit about what's called Black Thursday. That exhibit, by the way, is going to open at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum on 26th and Center early in May, and I think that would be something worth seeing.
Yes,
as well.
It would. And as long as Tim was calling from Minnesota, let's talk about another Minnesota guy. Who was involved in fair housing, and that's Senator Walter Mondale, who I believe, tell me what his involvement was. Did he talk about or initiate some kind of bill in Congress dealing with fair housing?
Right. There was a bill being considered in Congress through the winter of 1967 going into 1968, and it was eventually passed as the Civil Rights Bill of 1968. It contained fair housing provision that was largely the work of Walter Mondale and Senator Edward Brooke from Massachusetts. One of the things that I discovered when I was going through the papers they're housed at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, the Area Research Center papers about these actions was a copy of a congressional record in which Walter Mondale is arguing for the inclusion of a fair housing provision in the Civil Rights Bill, and specifically mentioned Father Grappi and the Milwaukee marches as raising the issue that needed to be addressed.
Thanks, Tim, for your call. We go to Frank next from Middleton. Hello, Frank.
Hi there. Wonderful poem. I was a bureau manager of United Press International in Madison.
Oh, really?
I'm the open housing manager.
Yeah, your phone is real bad, though, Frank, and we want to hear these words.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right. Anyway, I was a bureau manager of United Press International in Madison at the time, and they called me down to Milwaukee to cover these marches on the street. People in our Milwaukee bureau, I don't think, wanted to go out after dark. A couple of quick anecdotes. One was no cell phones. So in order to call in updates, I would knock on a door in the core area, and probably on three occasions. And they were African-American people, and they let me in warmly, let me use the phone. It was an amazing experience, that generosity. And the other anecdote was that I remember getting so much overtime during this that I decided that I would contribute to Father Gruppy's
campaign. Oh, Frank, this is a great story.
So I never told anybody about it because they might have thought I was biased. And, of course, I wasn't.
But, of course.
But there were a bunch of anecdotes. I still have the 16th Street march, a photo of that on my wall downstairs.
Oh.
Along with a black reporter. It was the first time that UPI decided maybe we ought to integrate our reporting staff here. And we did, and he was very good, and we enjoyed it. But it was a tough time. I remember that.
So tell me about that march. I think Margaret would probably like to see your pictures and meet you sometime, too.
All I remember
definitely.
Is peaceful. Yeah. I mean, they were marches, but they were peaceful. I was late on Kosciuszko. Somebody else was down there. But I remember on the north side, and I think it was around a Sears store or something, there were some gunshots fired, I remember, and people were taking cover, but nobody was hurt, as I remember. I remember the march across the viaduct as peaceful. That's what I remember. It was nothing like, and I covered the 68 convention in Chicago and a couple other things, and a lot of the street demonstrations in Madison during the war, Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So it, and I was out there at night and felt pretty safe, actually.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out do you have an email? You have an email, don't you, Frank? You have
yes.
A computer thing. If you could send me a little, the phone's getting bad. Where you are, so I can get your information to Margaret's, because you got a lot of history here. I think that she.
All right, let me see what I can do. What's yours?
Mine is Dunk, Dunnk at WPR.org. Is that the way
okay.
to do it, Margaret? Or do
That's
you want,
great.
Is that okay? So we can get the two of you in touch with each other.
Okay.
Great, Frank.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you know that, sir? They integrated UPI because of those marches. That's interesting.
That is very interesting.
Yeah. Could you read another poem?
Sure.
Whatever you want. I just wanted you to read the first one in the book because it really sets the tone for the 200 nights in one day, but there are a lot of other poems in this book as well. And we're going to continue taking phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation.
Maybe I'll read the one that's my version of crossing the 16th Street Viaduct. There are two poems that talk about the same event. One is from the point of view of Pam, who was actually a student at St. Boniface School. And the other one is mine. I grew up on the South Side. I had hung out on 16th Street. Used to go to Pepe's Pizza. I wasn't scared. I thought, I've been here before. It's nothing. Peggy, crossing the 16th Street Viaduct, August 28th, 1967. 16th Street, no big deal. In high school, after football or basketball games, we'd go to Pepe's. Great pizza. we'd always find friends there. Yet, I couldn't be sure. This was not high school, and I had new friends. We marched past Pepe's. I looked at the expanse of window. I touched the glass. It was cool and smooth. No one stood in this doorway. No one glared at us through their windows. I thought, it's okay. I know this place. I'll be all right. We'll be all right. I didn't look at the Crazy Jim's crowd. Too scary. Up ahead, there was a stretch with fewer people. When we get there, I thought, we'll be okay. But something changed. I felt like I had been in a tunnel and was emerging into noise, like the crowd of a football, like the noise of a crowd at a football game, the noise of the home team's fans, and you're the visitor. Oh, no. Listen, that's not it. Not even close. It's something deeper, a wave of hate, the sound of hate, blurring individual words. We turned onto Lincoln Avenue, the crowds thickening again. I couldn't ignore it anymore. The blunt force of hate finding a rhyme and a rhythm. I don't want to jig next door, keep them in the inner core. At Kosciuszko Park, we huddled around picnic tables, keeping very close to be able to hear. Some man called himself district park supervisor said we couldn't give speeches. A picnic permit, he shouted. A picnic permit does not permit speeches. We prayed for peace, for justice, Father Grappi leading us. Then back up Lincoln Avenue, sometimes almost running. Police, nightsticks angled up across their chest, sometimes pushed back on people, people trying to get at us. The crowd noise was like a dome enclosing us, the whole dome moving rapidly down the street. My face was wet with sweat. I was not crying. How had I walked these streets for years and never seen the ugly?
Oh. Thinking everything would be safe at home.
Wow. Yeah.
That's a very powerful poem. Very powerful. Let's go. We got to take a pause. We'll be back. Margaret Rozga is our guest. Her latest book is a wonderful and emotional and important book of history and poetry, 200 Nights in One Day. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Margaret Rozga is our guest. 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's go back to some phone calls for her. Barbara from Dubuque is next. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Margaret. It's so good to hear you this morning.
Thank you.
I've told this story many times, but never in this context before, because I didn't fully understand how it applies to today. I think the young people today are not aware of what was going on. I think it's very difficult for them to be aware because they didn't experience it. And so any stories that can be told or any way we can help them understand will make a big difference for our future. I'm 60 now, but when I was 7 years old, I lived in a small town in Iowa, and black people were not allowed in town. The only way they could even live in the area was there were boxcars that they allowed them to live in with no plumbing, no cooking, nothing. But they were allowed to have shelter out there. And as a lot of families, you heard the N-word all the time. And it was, you know, there was something wrong about it for me, but I didn't understand until one day my mother kept us home from church, and I guess she would have known that everybody in town would have been in church. And she had us gather up clothing and toys, and we went out, snuck out to those boxcars with that and some food. And she was taking a big risk. I understand a lot more now as an older person, but she was taking a big risk because my own father probably, I don't know what he would have done if he had found out. Mm. And I remember that I had picked up, not knowing exactly, I picked up a doll in my room and took it with me because I wanted to give that to whoever she was taking us to. And when I got out there, most of the people were really afraid to come out of the boxcars, but a few people came out, and Mom talked to them. And then I had the doll in my arm, and I saw this little girl peeking out, and I held the doll out to her, and it took her the longest time to actually come. And when she did, she just snatched it and ran, and I never saw her again.
Hmm. Margaret.
That is a stunningly beautiful story, and it reminds me once again that we are more with our history than we are without it. We are more with the poetry of actions like that than we are without them. We are more with each other than we are isolated and alone. Thank you very much for sharing that.
Thank you. Tom is next from Sheboygan. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Kathleen, Margaret. Thank you for taking my call. I agree that people today, young people today, don't realize how much bigotry and segregation there was in the North. They keep thinking the civil rights movement took place only in the South. I had a friend that marched with Martin Luther King in both in Montgomery and in Chicago. And we used to teach church school together, and sometimes she would talk about her experiences. She said in the worst confrontation she ever remembered was in Cicero in Chicago. The people were throwing bricks at the marchers as they marched up that street. And they had an armored car that they kept cash in for bailing people out of jail. And my friend had to put her two children in the armored car so they wouldn't get hit with these bricks that were being thrown. And, you know, that's a sad memory of those times. But it's true. The media makes it sound like it was happy days back then, and it wasn't.
Oh, no. As you say, it wasn't. You mentioned Laverne and Shirley. There was another thing going on here.
Right. And actually, the line in the poem that I first read about Chicago and to Cicero, I was reminded of that because I saw some video of exactly the march that you're talking about, and was shocked myself to realize how horrible it was. And you know, and we don't remember. And I think our sense of history gives us a sense of the possible. And if we don't remember, and we won't move beyond that time. And so I think it is important to keep telling these stories. And I thank you for calling this morning.
Yes, thank you. You know, I kind of hate to bring this up, but what happened, I was alive during those times as well, and I remember the day that so vividly when we were alive, we remember when Martin Luther King was shot. But isn't this, what does this say to us? April 4 of 68, King shot and killed. April 11, federal open housing law passed. April 30th, after defeating it six times, the Milwaukee Common Council finally passes an open housing ordinance that equals and surpasses the coverage in the federal law. Well, what does that say, Margaret?
Well, you know, civil rights workers used to talk about the fact that things don't happen unless we have a martyr. And I think that's probably what that says. You know, that's interesting, though, because when we were putting the play on the first production at UW-Waukesha, the director, Mark Lococo, said to me, well, didn't you celebrate when the open housing law was passed? And I couldn't remember, and I asked other people, and they thought we must have, but nobody had a clear memory of it. And then it occurred to me that what we had thought was all of our marching was for naught. It had to take somebody getting killed to get some advance. And then, so what happened was we wrote a celebration into the end of the play. And we thought, you know what? There wouldn't have been a fair housing provision if we hadn't been marching. And we did help to bring this about. And it's about time that we celebrated our accomplishment. So we wrote it into the play. And so 40 years later, we had the celebration that we didn't have then, because the death of King, you know, so overshadowed things.
It sure did. Well, a couple things. One is we have about 40 seconds. Can you read another poem? There are some short ones.
Let me just quickly say that the book is available at Woodland Pattern, and it will be available at Boswell Book on Downer.
And I also should ask, maybe we won't get to a poem because we have business to take care of. You also are doing readings in various places in Michigan and Madison and Milwaukee. Is there some place this list is available, Margaret?
It's available on the March on Milwaukee website.
Oh, good. Okay. MarchOnMilwaukee.org. March on Milwaukee.
All one word, MarchOnMilwaukee.
.org. Okay. So she'll be speaking all over the place for those of you in our
listening
audience.
And at the Sherman Perk Coffee House this Friday at 7 o'clock.
All right. Great. And she'll read more poems there because we can't do it here. And if you have stories, because we didn't get to all of our phone calls either, I'll get them to Margaret somehow. So if you use my email.
That would be great. I'd really appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. It'd be nice to gather those stories. And that's Duncan@WPR.org, and we'll send them her way. Well, I'm sorry. That was an hour. Thank you for the book. Thanks for the poems and your life. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Margaret Rozga, the book is 200 Nights and One Day, a book of poems that look at that era in our history, which is with us still in many ways. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your great calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow, and that starts at 9. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.